And welcome to another episode of GT Radio. Today I have a great fan and a colorful personality, Mr. Roy Corby. Roy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gino. You know, I've been following the show for a long time, and I've been waiting on my opportunity to get on and, you know, be part of the big time, some of the spectacular guests you've had on, so I appreciate it.
No problem, man. And you know, we've been friends for a long time, and I know you've had a pretty extensive career in the business. You know, on the outset, let's go back to where you grew up and, you know, what the atmosphere was like, you know, your surroundings, and also what your ambitions were as a kid.
Sure. You know, I was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, and I grew up in a town called West New York. It's right in between the Lincoln Tunnel and the George Washington Bridge on the cliffs overlooking New York City. And, you know, when I was younger, my parents moved to Massachusetts, like, almost immediately after my birth. So I grew up a Red Sox, Celtics, Bruins, Patriots, and clam chowder fan, not necessarily in that order. And we moved back to New Jersey probably when I was around 8. And I think it broke my dad's heart that he had raised a Red Sox fan, right? I mean, he was a diehard Yankee and Giant fan that just, he couldn't believe that. Where did he go wrong? How did he raise a Red Sox fan? But, you know, really, really cool area to grow up. You know, really mixed neighborhood. A lot of people had come straight from Cuba during the flotilla and had settled up there. And, you know, it was a really diverse place. It was pretty cool. And you look back now and you say, man, like 10 and 11 years old, I was, you know, taking the bus with some friends and going over to New York City. And my mom had no idea where I was. And you think today, your kids are never more than 5 minutes from you, you know, without the cell phone or anything, you know, you calling them and saying, where are you? So, yeah, it was a great time. Great place to live.
It was different back then, wasn't it? You could just go anywhere and people wouldn't worry, right?
It was, you know, and it's one of those things, like, it just, the news wasn't so prevalent. So all the same things were happening still. But it wasn't in our face, so we weren't aware that, you know, there were 30, you know, pedophiles living in our block. Like, now we can go online and find out exactly where they are, you know. So back then you just didn't really worry about it, you know. And it's true that your neighbors really looked out for you. You know, how many times your neighbors, you know, parents yelling out their window, "I'm going to tell your mom what you're doing," so you stop doing it. You don't see that nowadays.
I know, now you get a text, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Where are you?
Picture. I just saw your kid doing this, right?
That's
and
funny.
It's all there, you know? Or you see it on Facebook,
technology's
right?
Changed it. Yep.
It changed everything. Tell me a little bit about, you know, around that time, what were your – I know you're really into sports. Did you ever have any aspirations of becoming like a baseball player, a football, anything like that when you were a kid?
I wanted to grow up and play. I wanted to play college, big time college basketball. So, you know, I went to St. Anthony's High, or grammar school for a little while in North Jersey. And St. Anthony's was the number one basketball program in the country forever. And I was convinced I could play college basketball. And there wasn't a shot I wasn't afraid to take, right? So I would lead the league in shots attempted. Shots missed, scoring.
Oh, wow.
I was last in shooting percentage because I would shoot from anywhere. So, you know, that was the dream, but, you know, couldn't dribble. And
didn't materialize, yeah.
No. Thank God there were other avenues.
You pursued, right? You tried anyways. It's not like you were discouraged.
No, not at all. I tried to walk on at Syracuse, and that didn't work. And you know, found myself back in South Jersey. So I went to art school and became a casino dealer.
You went to art school?
I did. I had two uncles that were semi-famous artists, and that was always a love of mine. So I grew up drawing and painting with them and watching what they did, and they would take me to their studios in New York and introduce me around and everything. And so when basketball didn't work out, I went to art school. And you know, art school's a pretty interesting place. There was a 16-to-1 girl to guy ratio, so I was liking my chances. And
oh my God, that's great.
Yeah, what a terrible reason to pick a college, and but so be it. No reason to lie about it. And but
Yeah.
I finished art school, and I had already been dealing for a while, and I realized I like dealing better. I was
So
a slot attendant.
let me understand this. You went to college, and as while you were going to college, you were also dealing?
Yeah, so I was in Atlantic City, and I was so I was going to school in Philadelphia, and it's a 60-mile drive. So every morning I would get up and drive to school, and do my classes, and I'd go home at night, and I'd go to my job, and I'd deal. I actually was a dealer at one casino and a slot attendant at another, because in Atlantic City your license was your own. You could work as many properties as you wanted as long as they didn't care. So I worked in slots at one, table games at another, and went to college during the day.
Wow. Tell me a little bit about how you got your first job. How did that happen? How did that come about?
One of my best friends in high school had graduated the year before me, and he was a casino dealer, and he was just always talking about it. He loved it. The money was great, liked dealing with all the people and all. So, he just talked me into it. He'd go to dealing school. So I went to dealing school while I was in college also, before I started my actual job. I went to dealing school. And I learned craps was my first game, craps and baccarat. And, in Atlantic City, you have to go out to the casino and say, okay, here's my certificate. I finished dealing school. Will you hire me? And they throw you on a live game, right? So, it's like, because there's nowhere else
you
for them
died.
To test you. That's it. Get on the game. So they put me on a live game, and I was out on the craps table, and I was the stick person for four or five rolls. And all right, sending the dice, calling the numbers. Okay, come on around. Get on the base and do your thing. And so I jumped on the base, and the casino was busy. There was nowhere that they could have put me that was slow. So they're like, all right, let's just put them on and see what happens. And they got the box person there, and he's like, well, hopefully this works out. And they The side I'm on had a lot of action. And all I did was I put my hand down to straighten up the stack of checks I was going to work with, and I knocked it over. I knocked over the white stack.
Oh.
It was like a game of dominoes. It knocked over the red. It knocked over the green. And it's all in the boxes. I have no idea what anybody's bets were. The guy throws the dice, and he sevens out. The box person looked at me and said, I'd hire you because you're lucky. And that was it.
You got lucky.
I got lucky. So
and that's
they hired,
the name of the game in the gambling business.
They hired
that's
me because I was lucky.
What a story.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about
then,
Atlantic City back then, because people talk about Atlantic City now and, the transition and how it's like, fell apart. But at that time, Atlantic City was it, right?
Atlantic City was the mecca. I mean, Vegas was the Mystique, and Reno and Tahoe were open,
mm-hmm.
but this was really before Vegas had built the mega resorts, right? So Atlantic
right.
City was the mecca. You had people coming down from New York, and just throwing all kinds of cash on the table. People coming from Pennsylvania, up from Delaware. I mean, there was no other gambling on the East Coast. There was no Foxwoods at this time or Mohegan Sun. So we were it.
Yeah,
and
it was
an amazing time. You'd have the Mike Tyson was having all his fights in Atlantic City, at the at the convention center, if you're working at Trump Plaza at the time, every table would be $100 minimum. I mean, that's it. This is because we had the play for it. It was an interesting
crazy.
Time because it was still table games was still king back then, right? I mean, it wasn't 88, 89 is when it really started to change, and slots became the number one. Harris did a great job of changing everybody to slot players, tracking their worth and using the system a lot better than anybody else. But before that, man, table games was king, and Atlantic City was the spot to be.
What did you learn in that period? What was the lessons that you would walk away from that kind of you kept with your whole career?
You really got a Atlantic City got a real bad rep of being overregulated, and that we ruined it for gaming. Vegas was nice and relaxed, and the dealers can turn around and do whatever they wanted while they were on the game and high five the players. But Atlantic City was real rigid. But it taught you that at this time we weren't fully aware of all the scams that were going to happen in the casino business and how many people were making a career out of cheating in the casino. And it really gave me a great foundation of man, policies and procedures are there for a reason, right? You know, it's there
Right.
to protect everybody's job and to keep us all employed and making money and happy. You know, so I really enjoyed my time. I thought Atlantic City did a great job.
That's great. And what a time to be there. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
What happened after Atlantic City?
So I left Atlantic City the first time in 1995. Got an opportunity to open Harrah's New Orleans the first go around. So, you know,
Wow.
got down to New Orleans in 1995 for Mardi Gras. We opened the casino in March, and unfortunately, we also closed the casino in November. The first Harrah's New Orleans was a colossal flop. You know, the deal Harrah's had struck with the city to get that license, we just couldn't sustain a real high tax rate, limited comps, no restaurants, no hotel in the first go around. And everybody wanted the license. Everybody thought it would work. Caesars bid. Everybody bid on it. Harrah's won it, and it just didn't work. So I spent what, 9, 10 months in New Orleans. It was a great time. It was a nice place, you know, nice property, and a lot of great people got to work with. And but unfortunately, it just wasn't to be. But that set me up pretty good because the people who were there that ended up closing it with me all ended up in senior positions at Mohegan Sun. So while we closed, you know, Harrah's New Orleans in November of 05, I'm sorry, 95, we opened, you know, we opened Mohegan Sun in what, September of 96. So I went back to Atlantic City for 4 or 5 months and then ended up at Mohegan Sun. I'm part of the opening team there, so it was a nice transition, and that was my first
That's great.
foray into tribal gaming, and pretty much been in it since.
What was it like at that Harrah's property? I know they didn't make the, you know, they couldn't make the payments and everything, but what did you learn from Harrah's?
You know, Harrah's did such a great, great job of emphasizing the customer and knowing what the customer wanted and where the customer wanted to spend their money, right? Harrah's does a much better job at that than anybody of tracking every dollar back to a carded player and where that player was. So, you know, really, you know, spending the time there and seeing the preparation of opening that property and all the 2 months of role playing they put us all through on guest service, and they would during mock casino, they paid actors to walk through and put you in scenarios. Hi, sir, can you help me? Sure. What can I do for you? You know, I lost my wife. I
Wow.
can't find her. You know, oh, here, let me help you find
Wow.
her. I'll take you over to dispatch and we'll page her. Do you remember where you were with her last? I'll walk you over there. You know, I mean, they really went above and beyond spending money to open that property, and that really taught me a lot about
Wow.
preparation.
I never heard that before from anybody that they would actually bring in actors to role play, so because of the customer service. That's incredible.
And they'd film it. So if there was one that, you know,
Wow.
you didn't handle right, they would show you in a training room setting. So, like the example I just gave you was actually a true one. It was me and somebody else were walking to go on our break, and a customer said, "You know, hi, can you help me? I lost my wife." And the person I was with said, "Do you know where you are, sir?" And the guy said, "Yeah." "Well, then you're not lost. She is." Not what Harrah's was
Oh my
looking
God.
for. And we didn't know it was being filmed until they showed us.
Oh man, that is not the thing to say to a customer.
No, so it was real
It should be
entertaining.
like, hey, let me call security. We'll find her right away. Oh
Yeah,
God. That guy got reprimanded, of course, right?
yeah, he didn't last as long as the casino did.
Yeah. That's a great story. We talk a lot about mentorship on this show, and I know that a lot, you know, especially because of Atlantic City and Harrah's. Talk to me about some of those mentors and what they taught you on the way up.
Sure, I can name three specifically, three great guys. You know, my original craps instructor, Joe Phelps. You know, and me and Joe Fun, everybody called him. And Joe was probably the youngest pit manager in Atlantic City history, and worked at Harrah's and a senior executive host, and he became a craps instructor at the school I was going to. And Joe really taught me what it was to be a professional in the industry, to really embrace being a craft dealer, enjoying your job, you know, work with the guests. I had the pleasure of working with Joe again. He taught me crafts, and I had the pleasure of working with him at Harrah's New Orleans. He was one of the shift managers hired there, and then he was one of the shift managers at Mohegan Sun. So I get to work with Joe two other times, and you know, his appreciation for the job was infectious, and he loved the casino business, and I love the casino. I love everything about gambling, and I think that's because of Joe. And then, you know, Jack McGinney was a senior vice president for MGM, and he hired me at MGM Detroit. And, you know, to see how Jack would get so personally involved. I mean, he was senior vice president, and on the opening day of MGM Detroit, you know, we were packed. We had a line outside the door for a week of people waiting to get in. And the cage had massive problems. You know, we couldn't keep up. And Jack rolled his sleeves up and got involved by going into the cage and helping and balancing and exchanging checks for guests. It was great until the Michigan Gaming Control Board came down and said, hey, he's not allowed to be in there, right? His license does not allow him to do this. But it really showed you that, hey, a senior executive, a guy who was, you know, the number two guy on property said, I'm going to get in there and work with the cage cashiers. And then finally, a great guy named Giffen Tan, and Giffen was I worked for Giffen at Greektown. And, what I really learned from Giffen is don't shy away from the hard conversations and choices. Right, we're leaders in this business or in the property you're at, and there are going to be different difficult conversations you have to have, and you know how to handle them with professionalism and tact to make sure that everybody understands this isn't personal, but we need to address this. This has to change for us to move forward. So I've been very fortunate with, and there have been others along the way, but those three really stand out.
Now, that was earlier in your career too, right? So it really had a big impact on you.
Correct, correct. You know, Wendell Long was fantastic to me at Del Sol, and Wendell taught me trust. You know, he fully trusted me to run the business. The casino operations, while he handled, you know, the bigger picture, the financing, the branding, the tribal aspect of it, you know, and you know, an open line of communication between me and him to say, here's what I'm doing, here's why I'm doing it, and here's how it's going to help what you're working on with the tribe. So he was really instrumental in teaching me trust and how to delegate effectively and make sure that you follow through and follow up.
What was your first native casino that you worked at?
Mohegan Sun, 1996.
Wow! So you had that exposure early.
Yeah, basically
very early.
You know, from 1996 to now, almost my 21 years, 22 years has been all tribal gaming. I spent, you know, my time at MGM was brief, 6 months. Greektown was owned by a tribe, even though it was a commercial casino. It was owned by the Sault Ste. Marie tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spent a year and a half for Acres Gaming, or Acres 4.0. But really all our business was inside Native America. So really all my time in the last 22 years has been spent with tribes. I like that.
You've
I think
had
it's
a
so
combination. Yeah, and you've had also a combination of commercial and tribal gaming.
Yep.
So it kind of like you've had that the experience early for the good foundation, and then you can share that knowledge. Yeah, native gaming is amazing because you're building communities, right? It's more satisfying.
Exactly. You see where the money's going, and you know the tribes. I've been very fortunate that the tribes I've worked for have all been very very welcoming, and you know I've been able to be personally involved and witness some of the ceremonies and how, you know, the decisions we make affect that, you know. So, you know, you work in corporate America, and you know, and if at MGM, if I beat my budget by 20%, MGM's like, great, you know, good job, you know. But with the and that's how I would feel. But for the tribe, if I beat my budget by 10-20%, I feel like I shortchanged them. Like I didn't give you a good budget in the first place. And maybe you didn't provide all the services you wanted to provide to your members because you based it off a budget that I beat easily. You know, and so there's a personal responsibility on my side, too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay, that's pretty cool. Something I haven't heard before either. You know, we saw the economy tank in 2008. Now it's come back. How's the gaming business doing in Native Nations right now?
You know, it's interesting because if you look at all the national numbers, the numbers today are almost identical to where we were in 2008, right? But the problem is VIP market is making up a much bigger share. So we've lost some mass market, right? We're definitely seeing a decrease in headcounts at local properties across the country and local properties of the tribal properties for the most part. And we're seeing a decrease in headcounts, right? So our high end is making up a much bigger share. The economy, as great as Wall Street's been and everything else, not fully back in a lot of these areas. You know, you look at West Virginia with coal, gas is still, oil's still been somewhat depressed, although it's coming back. So a lot of these properties that rely on these markets, they're not seeing the mass numbers, but we're seeing the high end. So revenues are the same, are back, but probably we would like to see that, or at least I would like to see that more evenly dispersed among all of our tiers instead of just the high tier.
Gotcha. You're saying there's a discrepancy now where there wasn't before.
Not yet. It's not as it's much more defined than it used to be. So the concern is if it's not economic, right? So let's say that somebody calls in and says, "Roy, it's not the economy." Well, that could be true. But if it's not the economy, that means it's a much more dire situation. It means that people at the lower tier have decided that they just don't like our offering anymore, and they would rather do something else with their entertainment dollar. I'd like to
Right.
believe that that's not true, that it's more economic.
Right. And that potentially could pose a serious threat down the line if anything happens to those higher tier players.
Exactly, because at some
Right.
point they're
It's
going to
not.
feel right. You see, like the other day, where the stock market drops 1,100 points, you get a couple of those, and now your high flyers, your real estate agents, everything else, now they start to pull back on their spend, and if you lose the VIP
Right.
play, after you've already seen mass market decline, now you've got some issues.
Now you got some problems, right? Do you think that I know there's a lot of everybody's expanding, everybody's renovating, everybody's doing something. There's a lot of growth, a lot of new casinos opening. What is happening? Do you think there's a bubble? Do you think that there's just too much for the gaming business to handle?
I don't know that a bubble is a good term for it, but I think there are a lot of areas that should be concerned about the additional expansion or the possibility of additional expansion from their feeder markets. So, Texas, right? We know Texas is, not a gambling state now, and it may never be, right? The way the Texas law is written, it requires two consecutive votes, so 2 years in a 2 years in a row, the legislator has to vote for gaming for it to be in effect. So Texas could be 5, 6 years, 7 years. It could be a long time. But if Texas does happen, now the you look at Coushatta in Kinder, Louisiana, the Coushatta tribe, that's a serious threat to them. You have two tribal class two properties in Texas, right? It really puts a hamper on their activities. Oklahoma, how many people are
Yeah,
moving or going
Oklahoma.
north to Winstar if Dallas gets a casino? Know what I mean? So I think we should
Right.
all be concerned about overbuilding more than we should be concerned about total expansion. So, the properties, the big tribal properties that have faced adversity in the last few years, really it's because they're now overbuilt for what their current customer base is. They weren't overbuilt at the time, and who knew that expansion was going to come around the country that fast? But now we have a guide. We've seen it happen, and we should all be careful about overspending on our physical plant with expansion instead of just keeping it up.
Yeah, because what happens is you overreach without thinking about the future that there's going to be any changes, either to the, like you said, to the gambling base, or even more of a threat to other casinos opening up, right?
Sure. How many years have has some somebody in the Arizona state legislature put forward a vote to expand gambling to commercial gaming instead of just the tribes. You know, it always gets shut down, and hopefully and probably it always will. But if that ever does get opened up to full, not only do the current tribes have to worry about their market and are they overbuilt, but they have to worry about losing employees on top of it. And how do you replace those employees?
Right. What is the strategy for that? What should people be thinking when they're running their casinos? What is the how do you counteract that?
Yeah, you start by making sure that your value proposition is there, so that if a state in your feeder market, or even if your own state does open up commercial gaming, that your guests know that they've been valued guests of yours, and that you are reinvesting an appropriate amount back into them, not just in offers, but in time and attention, whether that's, you know, from your frontline staff, through their interactions, or leadership, management taking the lead and going down and welcome and greeting people, right? You have to make sure that they know that they're valued and that when they go somewhere else, they're not going to get treated the same way. And the same thing with your employees. They have to know that, you know, what their role is in the organization and how valuable they are to you, and you can't afford to lose them to a competitor, regardless whether that competitor is another tribe or commercial property. And that's, you build loyalty. And you can't build loyalty in your customers until you first build loyalty in your employees, because that's who's going to create that loyalty with your guests. So, you know, my wife will drive by every Seattle's best coffee shop to get to Starbucks. That's loyalty, right? And every month we have a fight. Every month we have a fight because she loads her Starbucks card with $100 on the first of every month. What other business do you send $100 to in advance and say, hold this for me, I'm going to use it sometime this month? If every one of my customers sent me their money in advance, I'd be thrilled, right? But that's loyalty.
Yeah, right.
Because she knows she's going to go there.
Right.
And Starbucks has created that, and we all need to. It's not that difficult of a business model. It's just a matter of getting by.
Right. Right. So give us an example of you know, how you create. Well, what you said was really, really cool, because you can't get loyalty with your customers without having loyalty of your frontline staff and your management, because they're going to be the ones that are going to create that loyalty with your customers. So how do you create the loyalty with your employees?
Sure. So constant communication. They know, they have to know everything that's going on and why. So in the last 6 months here, I've had to force some scheduling changes on some of the departments because I didn't feel like they were operating in the most efficient manner. So when we worked out the schedule changes, I was the one to sit down with all the employees in the department and tell them why. Right? They needed to hear it from me as a COO. And not from their department manager. You know, I needed to sit down and say, here's why we're doing it. I know I'm new and you don't know me, but here's why. And here's what it's going to mean for you. And here's what it's going to mean for the tribe. And here's how it's going to keep us all employed and help us grow the business. So I've met with just about every employee here to talk about what the vision is. You know, we don't, as an industry, we don't do enough meetings with our staff, town hall type, Apple type events where, hey, here's who we are, here's what we're doing, here's next year's marketing plan, here's what it means for your job. We don't. So that's how you create loyalty. They all feel like a buy-in to the property and what their value is to it.
What was their reaction when they saw you, the COO, talking to the frontline staff? They probably had never experienced that before.
They hadn't, and obviously not all of them were happy with the decision to make changes, and but they were all very appreciative that I sat there for as long as they wanted to sit and answered every question. And I did it for both departments. I took 5 days for each department and scheduled 4 meetings a day, so if anybody can make any of the meetings they wanted, or if they wanted to come back and hear what other people were asking me, you know, and we took notes and we posted them in there. You know, respective departments afterwards, so everybody knew what I said. And they loved it. Like, you know what, we've never had somebody at your position come down and talk to us about why we were doing these things, and we appreciate it. At least we know you listened. And some of them had some great ideas, and I made some changes to the schedules based on some of the comments and concerns that they had, because I don't know it all, you know, and certainly, you know, knowledge is to be had everywhere, and we should embrace that.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, because, you know, to have that kind of respect, that they respect you and they know that you're approachable, that's worth its weight in gold, right?
Yeah, exactly. So now they all know that they could approach me at any time in the floor and say, hey, I saw this, I noticed this, I think we should try this. And we do it a lot. You know, I have an open forum where, you know, they submit whether it's ideas for promotions or whatever, and if we use them, they get a dinner to the steakhouse, and, you know, I want them to feel like they're part of the property.
It's amazing. So one of the first times I've heard that. That's really a great strategy. So for anybody listening out there, that's pretty great stuff that everybody should use those kind of strategies, because I believe the relationship between people is what makes business move forward, correct? That's what makes it great.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, it's really great. Pretty cool. Talk a little bit about the responsibilities of a GM and what qualities make the GM effective. Now, you've already spoken about the relationship with the employees, which is, you know, amazing. But what other qualities, for people that are listening out there, what other qualities are important as a GM?
Sure. I'll start a little bit with the responsibility. What I think the main responsibility is, it's protecting the brand that's already been created by the tribe, right, and working with that. You know, the tribe has spent an awful lot of money and time and their efforts and their personal capital in creating something that's special and going to sustain them into eternity. And it's our job to protect that and effectively grow gaming and non-gaming revenues, right? I mean, that's our role here, and just to safeguard it while, you know, during our time. Yeah, I think the most important quality is communication and trust. So I talked a little bit about MGM before, and what I would say about MGM is MGM would hire me based on my interview, my resume, my references, and then they would trust me to do the job. And if the numbers don't match, they fire me. The tribe hires me based on some of the same things, resume, interview, and references. But the tribe then needs me to build trust in them. Right? I hired you. I think you can do the job. But I don't know you yet enough to trust you. And until I build that personal trust, I'm not going to be able to be as successful as I can be for them. You know, and that comes through communication skills. And whether it's with the frontline employees, the housekeepers, or whether it's up to, you know, the bankers who are capitalizing our projects or the tribal council, I need to be able to communicate with them on the level that they feel confident that I know what I'm talking about, and it's on a level that they're comfortable talking to me about. So communication and trust is the two biggest things. You know, everything in life comes down to trust, respect, and confidence. If I trust you, I'm gonna give you a lot of leeway to do your job. If I respect you, I'm going to give you that leeway. If I have confidence in you. If I'm missing one of those things or all those things, forget it. I'm going to micromanage you, and you're not going to be effective. So.
Yeah, that's very, very good. All right, this has been great. Let's open it up to some questions. I think we have the first caller is a little bit of a surprise. Hang on one sec. Hello, do you have a question for Roy?
What's going on?
Is that
you know
Mr.
That
Neely? Is that Mr. Neely?
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Corby. How are you doing today?
Great to hear from you, Steve. The smartest marketing mind in the business calling me. This is great.
Oh, please. Yeah, I got some hair product questions I wanted to run by you.
Have
you seen something
too,
about
so
Mary, you know what hair products to use.
And I'm also curious to find out how you were able to strike out at art school with that ratio of women to men. But anyway.
Yeah, you know, it was the ratio was great. I mean, and actually, it's probably higher than 16 to 1 because some of the guys I went to school with, you know, led an alternative lifestyle. So my ratio should have been higher than 16 to 1, and
yeah,
it still just didn't
yeah,
really work out for me. I've
oh,
aged
man.
Much better than my youth.
that's crazy.
No,
that's great.
Very insightful. As always, Tino, you do a great job with pulling great guests in and getting good content for everyone to listen to.
Thank you.
So as we, you know, we look down the road here, Roy, and we see what's going on in our properties, and you know, obviously the audience is getting older. The young people, like your son and mine, have figured out that online games are entertaining enough for them at this time. And of course, they don't have any money anyway, so not too worried. But what do you see happening in the next 15 years in our industry, and what role do you see technology playing in it?
Yeah, I you know, there's the key, right? I mean, so all the slot manufacturers are you know, working towards, you know, they've gone through the community games and things like that, and now they're working towards the skill-based games, and you know, there's some real potential there, but I still don't know that we're there. I mean, you think about two kids playing Call of Duty, right? And you say, okay, you know what? I'm doing this in a bar in your casino, so it's being played on big screen TVs on their own personal devices that are projecting, like Apple TV, so everybody can watch. But you, as the casino, you don't have to provide the hardware, because that's what you want. You want to provide the system, and you want them to log in with their own hardware because people are comfortable with their own devices. And you want them to be able to play, and you want people who are watching to be able to bet on or against certain things happening. But there's a lot that has to go into that, because how do you prevent people from throwing the outcome because of what the odds were? So that somebody they had, you know, a side deal with wins. So, you know, figuring out the betting mechanism, whether it's a paramutual along the lines of horse racing, things like that, is the difficult part. The technology is going to be the easiest part of this, and probably the acceptance of the guests is going to be a lot easier than we expect. The hard part's going to become in the regulation. How do we regulate this? You know,
yes, I agree.
Whether it's ADOG or Nevada Gaming Control Board in New Jersey, they hate the idea of this because it becomes difficult to catch cheats and thieves and everything else, and scammers. But that's where we're headed, and it's just a matter of how we bridge that and how we get there.
Good deal. Well, always good talking to you, Tino.
You take care, Steve. Hope you enjoyed the Super Bowl.
Hey, we didn't get the answer on the hair product.
Not as much as you.
On the hair product? I wake up like this.
You never got the answer. Are you going to leave our viewers or our listeners hanging? Because they might want to use this.
I just wake up like this. It just happens.
You wear a hairnet or what?
That's just funny. You guys crack me up.
Steve, thanks for calling in. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
Take care, Steve.
Okay. All right. Take care, bud. All right. That was great. Steve's a great guy.
Yeah.
And, of course, you've known him for years, right?
Yep. He's a brilliant marketing mind. Brilliant operation.
Good guy.
Smart
guy. Yeah. Let's go to our next caller. Hello. This is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Roy?
I do. You've worked at many different casinos across the country. What are the differences in gaming in different states?
You know, I've never really found a big difference in gaming. Obviously, we have some regional things based on the ethnicities that we might have in our market. So, and some jurisdictions just have a better table games play than others. But, you know, gaming throughout the United States, and I've managed a VLT, you know, the gray market up in Seattle to class 2 in Louisiana, you know, and class 3. So I've been exposed to pretty much every form of casino gambling in the United States, and I don't see a big difference as much as I see just some ethnic differences and propensities to gamble and what games they like to play. But really, people at the end of the
day, isn't there a difference? Like, if you're let's say if you're Mohegan North Star as opposed to Pottawatomie, Milwaukee, where you're right in the middle of, you know, a downtown area. I mean, isn't there that kind of difference when you go from state to state?
Well, what you see is right the fact that you're in the middle of a metropolitan area and you know your revenues allow you to do so many different things, marketing wise or total experience wise. I hate to talk about just the gaming experience because we should be talking about the total experience on property, right? You know, for years we talked about time on device when we should have stopped talking about time on device and talked about time on property. How are you spending your time when you're with us? Because time on device, we've got real efficient on taking your money, so your time on device had to go down. So talk about time on property. So, you know, being in a major metropolitan area or a great feeder market, you know, really allows you to do some cool, exciting things and still maintain a good cash flow and good profit margin that you don't necessarily get at the smaller properties where now you're just catering to the gambler and making sure that you provide a good, decent food outlet for them to enjoy while they're there.
Got it. Do you have another question for Roy?
Yes, one more question. What should a GM be looking for when he starts at a new casino?
You know, I start off the same way every time. I call individual meetings with all the department heads, and none of those first meetings do I ever talk about what my expectations are. All the initial meetings are, tell me about you. Tell me how long you've been here. Tell me what your department is facing and what the impediments are and how I can help you get things out of your way. And then I always follow back up in 4 to 6 weeks with, here are my expectations. Let me tell you a little bit more about me and what I'm looking to do. So when I first get there, I'm looking to see is there a semblance of team. Do people want to work together? And if they are working together, how could I strengthen that? And if they're not, how do I create that? You know, how do I help them get things out of their way? Every property I go to, that's the first thing I start with. Sometimes I'll take their evaluations and walk through what their previous GM had written. Hey, talk to me about this evaluation. Do you think this is an accurate reflection of you? If not, tell me why, right? So I can get an understanding of what you think, you know, you do and how you contribute around here. You know, I try to get them talking as much as possible so they get disarmed. People need to feel a buy-in, and people buy into your vision once they know that you've taken an active interest in the things that are important to them.
Yep, you're building the respect and the trust and all that stuff.
Yes.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
All right, good questions. Let's get another question here. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Mr. Corby?
Yes. Hi, Roy. It's Rich Hoffman. How are you?
Rich, how are you? Great to hear from you.
Good. Yep. My question is this. What is the goal for you professionally, maybe even personally, in the next 5 to 10 years?
You know, thanks. You know, I love what I do. I love what I do. So my goal really is to just be to make wherever I'm working as successful as it possibly can be. You know, on a personal side, I love gaming. Like I said, my parents were addicted gamblers. I was an addicted gambler. So I love everything about this business. So to me, you know, helping to create that experience and that love and passion of what I do for the people below me and then for that to extend to the guests, that to me is everything. Ultimately, I'd like to retire and live on the beach in Cabo San Lucas, but, you know, well, we're ways away from that. But, you know, until that happens, I'd be just as happy if this all came crashing to an end tomorrow and I was a dealer somewhere. I would be just as happy because I'm still in the business that I've been very fortunate in my life that, you know, I've gotten to be part of a business and career that I love, and it's afforded me a great lifestyle where I can move around the country and meet different people and see different things and just have great experiences. So I've been very fortunate. So I just try to give back on that every day.
That's great. Rich, you have another question?
At this point, no, I don't.
Okay. All right, Rich, you take care.
All right, great.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right, bye-bye. Let's go to our next question here. Good questions.
Yeah.
Hello. Do you have a question for Mr. Corby?
Yes. Hey, Roy.
Hello? How you doing? Yes.
Good, good. You know, Steve Neely, he might have touched on this a little bit, but I wondered if he could expand with just marketing to millennials. And, you know, what the plans are that you're doing now and what you foresee in the near future.
Sure. So, you know, I'll talk in general terms of my last several properties I've managed. You know, millennials actually are coming out to the property, right? We're seeing as much as 20% of our guests fall into the millennial
wow.
range, right? But they're only contributing around 8% of the revenue. So they're coming, but they're not spending much on the gaming side. But I guarantee you, if you dig deeper and you start to find ways to incentivize card use everywhere, you know, if you're in the bar, hey, do you have a player's card? I'm gonna give you 25 cents off the cost of a beer. Raise the cost of the beer 25 cents before you do this or whatever you're going to do. But now you can start to track back through the cards, you know, who your players are and how often they're there and, you know, what the demographic is, so that when you start to talk about new marketing campaigns and new ways of engagement, and you look at the different areas and you say, okay, so I have great opportunity in my bar to do different things. You know, and maybe we do some promotions that are just tied to the bar, you know, for this segment. So really, because while we're never going to be Vegas, we're never going to be 50, 60% of our revenues non-gaming, in most tribal facilities, actually probably in any tribal facility, we have the potential mm-hmm. to do much, much better than we are. So a lot of the millennials that are coming out to us have the money to spend. They just don't really enjoy what our current offering is. So if we're going to get an additional bar spend, lounge, whatever that is, out at the entertainment, great. Embrace that. Because ultimately, the idea is to just keep getting them out to our property and to keep spending the money that they have until we finally develop the portion of gaming that attracts them, right? You want them at your property just because they're going to eventually reach a different part in their life where they have more disposable income. They're going to enjoy the gambling experience that is now being offered at that time better, and you have already created some loyalty.
Right, yeah. Do you have another question for Mr. Corby?
Yeah. It's like the guy in New Orleans ever found his wife.
I love that story because I couldn't believe. You watched the video when they showed us the video, and my face dropped because I couldn't believe he had said that. Because like I said, we knew it was an actor, but we didn't know they were filming. So he thought he was safe, and it was just—oh, it was the funniest. Yeah, great times. Thanks for that. That's funny.
That's funny, man. That's a funny thing.
When the actor got that kind of response, did he just walk away, or did he engage any further?
No, he engaged further. He's like, "I'm sorry, maybe you didn't understand my question," and then the person I was with took him seriously. Oh, I'm sorry. So you meant you needed me to help you find her. Let me get right on that. You know, something like that. It was something still equally absurd, but it was you know, really, it was entertaining.
That's amazing. But right, what you said about the millennials is so true. I mean, if you're gonna, a lot of people talk, you know, about how they need to get like a game in there and how we're gonna get them to gamble, but if you look at it, for now, you can just get them to spend on, you know, the host, the other items that you have that are the leisure items, like the bar and, you know, anything else that you have, the club or whatever, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You look at it this way. Every casino, as long as you're 24. Every casino was the only 24-hour entertainment destination in the city, right? So here, you can come here. You can get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, have breakfast, go to the spa for a couple hours, then go golf, then go to lunch, gamble for a little bit. After you're done gambling, go up to your room and get changed, go to dinner, go to a show at night, and then end up back on the casino floor or in the lounge for 24-hour period. We are the only 24-hour entertainment destinations in our cities, right? So what are we doing to make sure that we are capitalizing on that for all 24 hours? You know, like you said, we focus so much on the gambling spend, and it's important, and we should. Our primary business is slot machines, and primarily it's low-denomination slot machines. That's where majority of the money is coming in. But we can't be so focused on that we're losing picture of, I've got 20% of my customers coming in, and they're only contributing 8% of my gaming revenue, but they're contributing probably 50% of my bar revenue. How do we get that up to 60% of my bar revenue? That's a big number. How do we get that up in my buffet? So they're already coming. That's find a way to monetize it.
That's a great point. Why hammer your head against the wall on the gaming when you can get them to spend, like you said, if I get 60% of their revenue in my bar, what am I doing? What is the strategy to market so I can get that up to 60%, right?
Exactly.
Those are the questions that you need to be asking. All right, that's great. Thank you so much. Great question. Let's move on here. One second. Let's see who this is. Hello, it's Radio. Do you have a question for Mr. Corby? Hello? This is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Mr. Corby?
Hi, Tina.
Hello?
This is Tesh. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
How are you?
Hi, how are you? It's great. Hey, Tino, it's Tesh.
Yeah. I guess we're having a little bit of a connection problem. Do you have a question for Roy?
Yeah, of course. Hey, Roy, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to say I've been to your property one time only about 10 years ago when I was in Albuquerque, and I mean, it really is a beautiful place. So I had a great time, and it's actually, I think it's really great to hear your perspective on gaming in Albuquerque. Great. So, yeah, I was just curious, in terms of your population there, and, you know, as I think as the city evolves and you guys, change your demographic to some extent, how are you finding, what are you finding are marketing challenges potentially in terms of, engaging with potentially the more younger audience, and, you know, what strategies are you guys kind of adopting? Are there any techniques you guys are using beyond direct mail and, more of the traditional channels?
Sure. Well, and thank you for that. So tomorrow night at the opening ceremony of the Olympics at 7:18 p.m., we will air a brand new television commercial. And the television commercial is going to focus on all of our amenities that are non-gaming. It's a 30-second spot, and it's really meant to drive your emotion on why you fell in love with Sandia in the first place, or if you haven't been here, it showcases really all the different things that we have to offer other than gaming. It says Sandia Resort and Casino. You know we're a casino. Most people can picture what a casino is that are interested in visiting a casino. What they don't know is what else do you have that's there. So if you look, you might have seen it, you might not, but I would recommend you look it up on YouTube if you haven't. MGM did a commercial late last year called Welcome to the Show, and it's brilliant. And it focuses on all the things their properties have that are non-gaming related. And that's what we should all be talking about.
Yeah, I saw that. That's
because
great.
We need to drive people to our properties for the other reasons.
Right? Sure.
People know we're a casino. They know there's tables. They know there's slots if they're already in your market. So what else, what are they missing about your property? How do you inspire emotion? Because we need emotion. We need to make that emotional commitment. So ours airs tomorrow, and I'm very excited about what the reception we're going to get.
Oh, great. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. It'll be on our website starting tomorrow night, too.
Excellent.
Great. Did you
Des, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, you were breaking up there a little bit.
Do you have another question for Roy?
Yeah, you know, I think that's this is a follow-up to that, Roy, and, I definitely appreciate that feedback. So, you know, in terms of, speaking about these other channels beyond, for instance, your or these other features of your property, have you guys, adopted any kind of digital marketing? Because, you know, look, television obviously is expensive, and, you know, there's a lot of costs when it comes to postage and a lot of these opportunities. So, you know, just curious if you guys are using any of the more affordable options, and if you've seen any results from, any of your other digital marketing approaches.
You know, not a lot in the way of results yet, right? So we obviously look to use YouTube, Pandora, things like that, right? There's all
sure.
kinds of channels out there to reach people that are you're absolutely right. They're very inexpensive for a much wider array of people.
Sure.
But the problem is we don't know the spend of those people. So while it's a very cost effective way, we might be talking about a penny for every 100 people we're reaching, but we
right.
don't know if there's even any return on that penny, which is the problem. So we like to do some, cute, hey, here's who we are type things, 10, 15 second teasers, if you will,
yep.
On those different channels, just to try to get people interested in who we are. But it's really tough then to track that.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, great question. Thanks, Ted. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Thanks,
yeah,
Ted.
Of course.
Appreciate it.
Of course. Yep. Thanks. Bye.
All right. I think we have
your callers pay attention. They like to ask some good questions.
Well, I think you're our 20th episode. So, a lot of people have been listening to the show and saying, I never knew that about so and so, and I never knew about this, and they're finding out. Look, when we go to these conferences, what do we hear? We hear, this is the best marketing method. This is the best slot machine. We're just inundated with vendors trying to sell us something, right? So I wanted
right.
to, when I came up with this idea, I said, you know what? There's no selling on the show. This is going to be a show about what people's lives are about and how they got to where they were. It could be any business, but we just happen to be in the casino business,
Right.
And people have, like you said, you heard Ken's interview and you heard when John James was on and Conrad Perdido. And, these are very respected people in our business, Steve Neely, all these people. But what does anybody really know about them? I mean, how many people know that you went to art school and you started out as a dealer in Atlantic City and,
right.
and went to school at the same time? I mean,
yeah.
That is fascinating to me. That really tells who you are. And how many people know that when you get to a property, the first thing you do is, say, hey, whoever wants to meet with me, I want to find out about everybody here. I want to know what's going on. I mean, people don't know that. And I think
yeah.
that's so important, and that's what we need. That's what we need a lot more of that. So that's my goal with the show. And, having guests like you is just amazing. I think we've got time for one more question here. And then we'll sign out. Hang on one sec. Hello, this is GT Radio. You have a question for Roy.
Hey, Roy. How's it going? It's Golly. Sorry. Hey, sorry about your Patriots, but I'm a Jets fan, so I've had a lot more grief in my life. I've had your
that's funny.
And the football fan. But
how many people know that you're a diehard? A diehard Patriots fan, and you're bummed out today, about the whole.
Everybody at my job knows because they all knew their day was going to be so much better Monday if we had won than if we had lost.
In a way, I like the Patriots being in the Super Bowl. So I have somebody to root against. I think I hate the Patriots more than I like the Jets. So, anyway.
You better ask a question before you get in trouble here.
Yeah. Wanted to congratulate you again on the Gigas India. I know you've moved around quite a bit over the last few years, but so have many other people that are in your position. I was wondering if you could talk about how you know, moving around, how that impacts you having to move and having to move your family around all the time, having to, you know, establish new relationships possibly in new environments. And what is that like for you, you know, professionally and personally? And then a follow-up to that is, how do you think that tribes need to do a better job in maybe having more stability in the upper management to have better results?
Yeah, you know, this has been my, now this is my favorite question of the day, and I appreciate that. You know, me and my wife just talked about this 2 days ago because my family's still in Tucson. We don't move the kids during the school year anymore. And I got this job after the kids had already been enrolled in school. And we had moved them, you know, twice in the last 3 years during the school year. My daughter's like, I don't want to move again during the school year. I'll start the new school year new, but I don't want to be the new kid in January. And she's a sophomore in high school, and you don't, my parents moved a lot when I was a kid, and I took it pretty easily. And I guess I just kind of assumed, since I took it easily, that all kids do, right? Kids bounce back pretty quickly. We do know that. But, you know, it doesn't mean that it doesn't take a toll on them and they become a little jaded about meeting new people and making friends and things of that nature. So, yeah, we were talking about this the other day that, you know, it's easy on me, right? We moved to a new place, and here's her exact quote. You hang your suits in the closet, you go to work. I've got to build the house. And she's right. And I never really took that fully into consideration. And you know, I'm lucky that she's such a strong woman and is capable of doing that, but that doesn't absolve me of any responsibility of being helpful. So, you know, it definitely takes a toll, you know, on your family. And you know, stability is something that we all crave. You know, I had it in Tucson for 8 years. But I don't know that I blame the tribes as much. You know, we always hear that, oh, that tribe's crazy or that tribe's crazy. I don't believe that's true. I believe that the person in the top spot didn't do a good job of creating that trust and that loyalty, right? So I can go in and talk to my tribal council, my tribal leadership, and say, here are the plans I want to put in place, and here's why I think it's going to be successful, and here's what it's going to take us to get there. And at the end of the day, if they say, hey, no, Roy, you want a zig, but we want a zag, it's my job to say, it's your property. If you want a zag, we're going to zag. And it's my job to make it as successful as possible. It's not my job where if it's not successful to come back and say, see, we should have did it my way. Right? It's my job then to go out and say, okay, here's how we're going to make this work. And here's how successful we can be doing it this way. And you've got to create that attitude about it that, yes, I didn't own this. I didn't build this. Yeah. They did.
No blame game. Just go in, and if they want to do it that way, you got to try your hardest to make it do it that way.
That's it. And the people below me will never know which decision was mine and which decision was tribal council's. That's irrelevant.
Right.
It's irrelevant.
Right.
It's my job to go out and sell it. So,
right.
So I don't blame the tribes, you know, for the lack of stability in tribal gaming. You know, some of it is you have people in our positions who are constantly looking for the next best job, right? So,
right.
Well, I'm going to take the Sandia job because it's 2,000 slot machines, and then that opens up bigger doors for me. You know, that's a we've seen it. We all know people. We see their resumes are 3 pages, 4 pages long. So I don't blame the tribes. I think the tribes will be as stable as management wants to be and allows them to be.
That's really good answers. How long did it take you to hang up your suits?
I'm sorry, what?
All right. So I said, how long does it take to hang up your suits? You must have a lot of them.
I've got a lot of them. I am a clothes hog. She's absolutely right about that.
Why did I know that?
I get the bigger side of the closet.
Oh, my God. That's got to be a first. Oh, my God. That's crazy. Golly, do you have anything else to ask Roy before we sign off here?
No, I think that was a good question to end it on. I think
okay.
Thanks again for being on the show. Really appreciate that, and hope to see you soon.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate the opportunity. This was a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it. And look forward to seeing you guys again and listening to your next show.
Roy, thanks so much for being on the show. And before I sign off, I want to get you and Neely on a show. So we'll plan that for sometime in the summer. Are you game?
I would love that.
Okay. So that'll.
I would love that.
We got a show coming up. I think in in March, where we're going to have John James and Conrad Granito. So I'm going to start teaming up people that I've interviewed. I think it's going to be really great. So
that'll be a lot of fun.
Put that in the books. Yeah.
Okay, guys.
Right,
thank you.
Thanks so much. We'll see you on the show again. Okay. Bye bye.
Take care.
All right. Bye. All right. That was great. Roy had a lot of really, really amazing things to say. You know, every person that comes on the show is completely different, and they're just a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of stories. And I'm really enjoying doing the show, really enjoying the guests, and I hope that the listeners out there are getting a lot from it. Remember, everybody's got a story to tell. You just have to have time to listen. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening. We'll see you in the next episode.